My name's Ray Moss, and I'm a responsible alcoholic.
Hi, Ray.
Celebrate sobriety. Man, I've had a great weekend. My wife and I drove in here on Friday from Greenville, South Carolina. We live in a little place called Traveler's Rest. Isn't that beautiful? Traveler's Rest, right at the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains. And I'm a member of the Traveler's Rest group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet on Monday nights and Thursday nights. If you're ever up that way, if you want a meeting or need one, or if you don't want one, just call me and we'll go to one. We drove in here from South Carolina and had forgotten how hot it was in Florida. We used to live down at Daytona Beach, but we had forgotten it. But we got into the fellowship here with you folks, and my, how wonderful it's been. And I've celebrated my sobriety this weekend. And I'm here to rejoice this morning. You see, folks, I've beaten the odds. Isn't that great? We've beaten the odds. I just read some new statistics. 85% of all alcoholics will die. Only 15% of us are going to live. Live or die, I'd rather die than be drinking, and I think you would too. But isn't it marvelous that we're here to celebrate our sobriety? I want to thank Bob for inviting me, and I want to thank the committee for agreeing to invite me. And I want to thank you folks for being here. You've allowed me to hear God speak this week. You see, I've sat in a number of your meetings, our meetings, and I've heard God here in Florida. I've been listening for Him and to Him for a long time, and I've never heard Him except that He's spoken through someone like you, and I've had the privilege to hear Him speak. I heard a young man say some things the other day that I'd never heard before. I mean, he's young. He's got 10 years in the program. He's still less than 30. And I heard him say some things that I know only God could have said through him. So I've listened carefully. And I want to thank you. I've met people like Ella, 36 years in Al-Anon. I never met anybody that old in Al-Anon, see. I thought my wife was an old Al-Anon. And no, she's only got 11 years in Al-Anon. But here's a lady with 36 years. Marvelous. I've listened to her. We've had conversations together, and I'm amazed that God speaks through Al-Anon people. But He does. He really does. He has taught me more through Al-Anon than I've learned perhaps in any other way and from any other people other than from alcoholics and from AA. It's wonderful to be together. Bob Polk. I'm sorry, Bob. Bob P. You know, I've lived around the country some in Southeast since I've been sober and in recovery. And I've got sponsors in every place I've lived. And Bob is, I haven't lived there in Tifton, but I get down to Georgia quite often. And Bob's my Georgia sponsor. I check bases with him. And when I go around, he's taping if I'm sharing my story, if I'm involved there. And I asked Bob, I said, Bob, how am I doing? And Bob said, I've got a 90-minute tape in this morning. I don't have any idea what he meant by that, but got a 90-minute tape. So Bob's been helpful in my sobriety. He introduced me to tapes about 8 years ago. He said to me, you know, take this tape and listen to it. I hadn't listened to any tapes, but I listen to a lot of them now, and I believe in them, and I pass them on to other people because there are times when I can't read. Riding in my car, driving, I got no business trying to read the big book. I can listen to big book tapes, or I can listen to speaker tape. And that's been a vital part of my recovery. I recommend that to you if you're just getting started. It's another aspect of recovery for all of us. I don't need Bob to tell me how long I can speak. See, I don't even have to look at my watch. I learned a long time ago that how to time a talk. Can be done easily. I learned it from a preacher friend of mine. He told me this story. He said when he had gone to his first church, his first appointment, that he learned how to do it. He said, I started preaching at about 11:30. At about 5 minutes to 12, I stopped. Never had to look at my watch. Said I had a way of doing it. And after several months in that congregation, he preached every Sunday. Started at 11:30 and quit at 5 minutes to 12. They sang a hymn. They got on out, beat the Baptist down to Shoney's for lunch. And he said an old boy came up to him after several months and said to him, Reverend, how do you do that? He said, how do you start at exactly 11:30 and quit exactly at 5 minutes till 12. Well, he said, it's no problem. Said, I learned it a long time ago. Said, I take a cough drop and I put it in my mouth right before I start to speak. And when that cough drop's gone, I stop. Well, a month or so after that, one day he was preaching and he went to 12:15. And it's 12:30. And a quarter of one, finally somebody raised their hand. He quit. Same old boy came up to him and said to him, Reverend, what in the world happened today? And he said, you know, I put a button in my mouth by mistake. Now, I can assure you I've got a cough drop. I'm married to an Al-Anon. God worked a miracle in her life a little over 11 years ago. And I've been living with that miracle ever since. And I want to thank the program of Al-Anon for helping this alcoholic to achieve some sobriety. I'm glad Betty's with me. We were not together for a long time, physically or spiritually or mentally. We weren't together, and we are today. And it's marvelous to have her with me. I'm an alcoholic from the day of conception. Maybe not an alcoholic, but I live in an alcoholic home from the day of conception. Alcohol has been a part of my life ever since I can remember, farther than that. My dad got sober in his last 6 years of life, and I had some good talks with him, and I said to him one day, Dad, do you think that you were drunk when I was conceived? Oh, he said, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. I was drunk all the time, so... You see, alcohol has been a part of my life from conception till today. Some of it bad, some of it good, but it's still been a part of my life. I grew up in an alcoholic home. Now, I don't know whether that made me alcoholic or not. I kind of doubt it. But it did some things for me that added to that vial that Frank talked about last night. I thought that was a great example, and I identified with it. I can always remember that home. I learned a lot of things in it. I learned how to be fearful. I was scared to death till I got to be an adult. I don't know what I was afraid of. I just prayed. I learned how to fuss because that's all I heard in my family of origin. Mouthing and arguments and fear and hatred. And I learned all that. I learned how to have resentments. My dad is the alcoholic. And in that home, he was a periodic, and you could never predict what he was going to do. He might come home and not drink for a month. And he might come home and be good, and 30 minutes he'd be gone and drunk. And I used to lay awake at night. God, I can still remember those laying awake hours and wondering, is he going to come home? Praying that he wouldn't come home. And then praying that he would come home because I was afraid that something had happened to him. And when he'd come home, it'd start. It wasn't all his fault. Mama just left him alone. It might have been different. I always thought that. And I hated her. I had resentment. See, I grew up hating my parents. Big Book calls it resentments. I call it hate. I just hated them. My dad was drafted in the Second World War along about 1942. He was gone 4 years, and I prayed for him every day. I know I prayed for him every day. I prayed that he'd die. I prayed that he'd get killed and not come back home, because when he wasn't home, things were a little bit better. But he didn't get killed. He came back, and if I ever believed in God, I quit believing in God that day. Because as soon as he got back, he started drinking again, and hell began to happen once again in that family. So two things happened. I learned early in my life that God wasn't real. Didn't make any difference anyway, so why should I believe in him? And I learned that you couldn't trust your parents. You couldn't predict. My dad was not predictable. I learned a lot of things about him. I learned that he was ignorant. I said, I'll never be like him. I won't drink like him. I won't be as ignorant as my old man. My first grade teacher was named Miss Montgomery. See how we remember those things? Never did remember it till I took an inventory, but my first grade teacher's name was Miss Montgomery. I must have been sick one day and had to have an excuse to get back in school. My mom worked second shift, Dad's home. I asked him to write me an excuse to get back in school. He couldn't spell Miss Montgomery. Sent me uptown with a piece of paper. Look at the Montgomery Ward sign, write it down. I said on my way back home, I'll never be like him. And I set out not to be like that man. I heard 1,000 times in my drinking from my wife, you're just like your daddy. God, I hated to hear that. I learned to drink from my dad also. My dad couldn't drink in the house. I was raised in the mill village. And I'm not sure in Florida you understand what textile village is, but it's a little mill village around the textile mill. Little houses. We lived in one of those little houses, little three-room house, and in the kitchen was a little pantry. It wasn't but, about 5 by 7, but that in that little pantry, Mama kept all of her flour and her meal and all the stuff that goes into making good food. And that was my daddy's bar. He couldn't drink in the house, but he could drink in the pantry. And he'd go in that pantry and shut the door, and I'd hear him rustling around in the back corner. I'd hear him say, God almighty, that tastes good. And, you know, he'd shiver and shake and make a noise. And then he'd come out and he'd feel good. After about 2 or 3 trips, he didn't shut the door. And I saw him. He'd reach down, get that little bag, strip down the top of the bag, and turn that bottle straight up, shake like a wet dog, and say, that's good. And then he'd want to dance with Mama. And Mama wouldn't dance with him. And he'd get a broom. And he'd dance all around the kitchen with a broom. And I thought, that's the craziest old man I've ever seen. Now, let me tell you, I've been drunk before, and nobody danced with me, and I have danced with a broom. But I learned to dance from my daddy, and whatever I do dance, and I learned to drink from my dad. One day, he was gone, and I said, if Mama's ever gone, Dad's ever gone, I'm going to slip in there in that pantry, and I'm going to get me a drink of that. And I did. And you see, I stripped the bag down, turned the bottle straight up, and took me a great big swallow, and I shook like a dog and said, man, that's good. And it didn't come back. And things happened. I didn't feel good. I don't believe a drink of liquor or alcohol ever made me feel good in my life. Let me tell you what it made me feel. It made me forget. You see, I hated to be a Mill Hill boy. I hated to be a lint head. My grandfather was, my daddy was. Everybody I knew were Mill Village people, and I didn't want to be one. But when I had a drink of alcohol, it didn't matter. It didn't make a bit of difference where I was from. When I had a drink of alcohol, it didn't matter that my dad was an alcoholic. I kind of liked the old boy. When I had a drink of alcohol, it didn't matter what my mama had said to my daddy or what she had said to me. It just didn't matter. And I pursued that feeling almost to death and back. Trying to change how I felt about you and other things. I think I was alcoholic early in my life. I had blackouts when I was 13, 14 years old. I went to school. Shouldn't have been there, and sometimes got sent home at 15 because of my drinking. So that leads me to believe it. If I wasn't alcoholic then, I certainly was close to it. I married the prettiest woman in my hometown. My wife doesn't like me to say that, but see, I know that I pick them well. I look at the albums now, and I can say, by golly, she's the prettiest girl in our home, in our school. And she lived on the other side of the tracks. She didn't have a bit more than we did, but she didn't live in the mill village. She lived outside the village, and so I went after her. The book said she had what I wanted, and I went the end of length to get it. Traveled hard and worked hard and for her and finally got her. We were just kids, just turned 19 a few days when we got married. God, I loved her. Not many years after that, I told her one night, I don't love you anymore, Betty. It wasn't because that I didn't love her, I just didn't know how to love her anymore. We have two children. When our first child was born, a daughter, not long after that, some strange things happened to me. I think you'll understand this when I say it. I didn't go to church. I didn't have anything to do with God. He had not been in my life for a long time. But somehow or another, God got me from the rear end. He just slipped up on me. The longer I stay in this program, it might be that I was so guilty that I just reached out for God. But anyway, he got me from the rear end. And in that conversion, I was saved, if you follow me. I met God of my understanding, and he altered my life. And for a long time, I didn't drink. And I didn't do anything that was wrong. And coupled with that conversion experience was a call to the Christian ministry. And I answered that call as best I could as a 24-year-old man. I'd quit high school when I was 16, and I thought he just called me to preach. But he called me to go back to school first. And I had to go back to high school. And then on to college, and then on to graduate school and seminary. For 14 years, I didn't do anything wrong that I know of. I was a clean, living, young clergyman. My wife and I had one of the finest Christian homes that anybody could ever have. And if you can ever be on your way up in the church, I was on my way up in the church. Everybody liked me, and I liked everybody else, and I got along well with everybody, and I was a good preacher, and I was a good pastor. Let me tell you what happened. One day, I was playing golf with a young doctor, and I was in graduate school, driving 120 miles a day round trip to school, had two big Methodist churches in the rural section, a lot of people dying, a lot of people getting sick, a lot of people being married, had a lot to do, and I couldn't sleep at night. And I said to this young doctor, Bob, I can't sleep at night. And he said, that's not a problem. I'll give you a prescription if you'll come by my office. And he did it. And he gave me, I've never seen him in my life, a yellow Sinconal sleeping capsule. And I took it. Did exactly what I needed to have done. It put me to sleep. Now, after a period of time, it didn't put me to sleep. See, my body required more than one after a period of time. I'm not sure whether it was a year or 6 months. Time's not relevant, but I went back to see that young doctor because, by golly, you just can't make 30 pills last 30 days if you're taking two of them a night. It just won't work. And I went back to see him, and I said, Bob, I lost that bottle. I hadn't told a lie in years. And he said, that's not a problem, and he wrote me another prescription. Now, you see where I'm headed? I got two prescriptions now, and I got one doctor, and I got two drugstores. Well, I didn't use any alcohol for years. See, I preached that alcohol was bad. The use of it was bad. God, I still got some good sermons. I got some good sermons on the evils of alcohol. I wouldn't take the world for them. I'm going to publish them sometime. But I didn't drink. But see, I didn't know this. My mind didn't know the difference between liquid or pill. And good Lord, I began to do some things that no one does, and certainly not a minister. I mean, I wouldn't tell you all the things that I did, but I lied, and I cheated, and I stole, and I had affairs, and I know today that it would never have happened if I had not have had my inhibitions broken down with that substance. Oh, it wasn't long after that, you know, that I took a drink. I was had moved from the pulpit ministry. It's awfully hard when you're preaching to people like out here, you know. And you're supposed to be preaching about sin and against it. I couldn't think of anything to preach that I wasn't already doing. It was awful hard. So I went to ask the bishop if he'd move me and get me out of the pulpit ministry. And he put me in a special ministry. I didn't have to preach anymore, not down to people. I was at a party one night, and attorney friend of mine said, have a drink, Ray. And I said, Bob, I think I will. And I did. And it was all downhill from then on. You see, that's the drug of my choice. It started out being my drug of choice, and it still is, and I know that. I need to tell you some things that help me remember that the first and second steps were so much a part of my life and still are. I don't ever want to forget how powerless I am and how it takes a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity. I told you once the most important thing that I need to remember is that I said to my wife once, Betty, I don't love you anymore. It wasn't because I didn't love her. It was because I didn't know how to love her. You see, I'd fallen out of love with her and fallen in love with alcohol. It had become the god of my life. And that started some bad times in our family. It's hard to love somebody when you've told that person you don't love them. And she tried, but it was so difficult. Church didn't know what to do with me. Good Lord, what do you do with a drunk preacher? They didn't know I was drunk. I hid it just as well as an attorney hides it or a housewife hides it. I hid it well. I envied you people. You see, you could walk into a liquor store anywhere in wherever you lived and buy as much as you wanted to buy and carry it out and speak to everybody that you met going in and coming out. And I couldn't do that. I hid every drink I took. I hid. I used to sit for sometimes 30 minutes looking in one of those self-serve liquor stores. Y'all got them in Florida, I know. Well, we had a few of them in North Carolina. And I'd sit there in that parking lot looking around. I'd wait till I hoped there wouldn't be a soul in that liquor store so I could rush in and buy what I needed and rush back out. That's hard work. That's hard work. And one day I went in and one of my church members was coming out, official in the church. I didn't speak to him and he didn't speak to me. And to this day, we've not spoken. Not about that. How hard it is. I went to work for the state of North Carolina. You know, we fall up steps. I never fell down steps in my drinking at all. I never fell down. I always stumbled up. And I stumbled into a beautiful job for an alcoholic. We were having had a political change in the state of North Carolina. The first time since Reconstruction days, we elected a Republican governor. Somewhere along the line, I had registered a Republican. I don't know when, must have been drunk when I did it, but I was a Republican. One night I'm lying in my bed drunk, and the telephone rings, and another friend who had stumbled into an appointment with the governor had said to me, Ray, you want a job? And I said, well, I expect I need one about now. It's time for me to change. And he offered me a job with the state of North Carolina. So I was working around people, it seemed like everybody around me was divorced. And Betty and I weren't getting along too well, so I decided we'd just get a divorce. And we did. Lord, what an experience. I don't know why I needed a divorce, but I got one. Now, in the midst of all the crises that go along with a divorce and the anger and the guilt, I should have been concerned about my family. I should have been at least concerned about my children. But let me tell you what I was concerned about that will help you understand how insane I was. You know, Methodist ministers live in church parsonages, owned by the church, furnished by the church. I'd never had a bar in my house, ever. Church didn't like that. They'd have frowned on it. So I went out and I bought me a bar. As soon as I got me an apartment in a swinging singles complex. I was 44 years old and I'd never swung in my life. And I got married when I was 19, and in between there I'd never had much swinging. So I figured I was going to swing some, and I went out and got me a bar. It was a nice one. It was not leather top, but it was imitation leather. And I went to the liquor store. Now, remember I told you I drank like my daddy. I learned to drink from him, like him, right out of the bottle. That's the only way I ever drank, straight into a glass and straight up and straight down. But I went to the liquor store, and I bought it by sounds. I read the name. You know, it sounds so foreign. Shenley's. I never drank any Shenley's in my life. Chivas Regal. I never drank any of that stuff, but I bought it. I bought it by the color. Red, white, dark, light, you know. Put it in the buggy. Took it home. Put it in a liquor cabinet. Had me an old chair. Didn't have much furniture, but I had an old chair. Now, let me tell you how I drank. I had a townhouse. About 20 steps up to the bedroom. I had a bar 10 feet from that old chair, and I'd walk up those 20 steps over to the closet, open the door, reach back in the far corner of it, strip down the bag, pour it in a glass, set it back, walk downstairs, set down the chair, drank that glass full, walk back up the steps. I never took a drink from that bar. Nobody lived there but me and an old white cat, and he didn't drink. You know who I was hiding from? God. You see, it was wrong for me to drink. It was wrong for me to be doing the things that I was doing. It was wrong for me to be divorced. And I was hiding it from God. And I'd been doing that for a long time. I don't know how long Betty and I were divorced. We don't even count it anymore. I can't remember. But I had a need in my life to get remarried. I decided that I was tired. God, it's so hard to be drunk. And I wanted to be sober. And I didn't know how to get sober. I didn't have anybody to talk to about it. And I wanted to be sober so bad. And all I could remember were those happy years when Betty and I were so happy. When I had a couple little churches. And I was a good man. I was honest and wholesome, free and at peace. And I wanted those again. And I didn't know how to get them. But I thought if I could just maybe get me a couple churches and go back to preaching and get out of this foolishness that I was in. So I went down to a central part of North Carolina, to Charlotte, where the bishop of the Methodist Church lived. I made me an appointment with that bishop. I went in to ask him if he would give me a couple of churches. Now, I wasn't going to tell him I was drinking, but I just want to tell him I needed to preach again. And when I got in there and sat down in front of his desk, black Mississippi bishop, tough man, he had my records in front of him, and they were thicker than the big book. And I don't imagine most preachers' records were that thick, but we got into the conversation eventually. I said, Bishop, I'm looking for an appointment. I want to preach again. And he said, Brother Moss, you're divorced, aren't you? I said, yes, sir, I am. And he said, well, I have never appointed a divorced minister in my life to a church. I don't intend to start. Now, I learned when I was 3-4 years old how to lie. And I could tell one quicker and make you believe it faster than anyone I knew. And I said to him, Bishop, I'm fixing to get married. I wasn't even seeing anybody. He said, who are you going to marry? And I said, well, I'm fixing to remarry my former wife, Betty. Well, he perked up a little bit, you know. I think he thought that there would have been some redemption in that. And he said, Brother Moss, if you can do that, I'll give you an appointment. Now, Betty wasn't hardly talking to me. And if it hadn't been for an 11-year-old son, she would have never spoken to me again. But we had to communicate about him. Well, I called her up. Now, I got this plan in mind. You know how alcoholics take a plan and we'll work the hell out of it. And I set that plan in motion in that 75-mile trip back. I had that plan going. And by the time I got back to where I was going, I probably had it already. And I made this great move. I called her. And I invited her to go out. And we began seeing each other. And I spent more money on her then than I've ever spent before that or ever spent since that day. And one night, we had been seeing each other for a while. The wine was poured, the lights were low, and the candle was lit. And I said to her, still drinking, maybe drunk, Betty, will you remarry me? And this woman, who is as stupid as I know anybody could be and as crazy as anybody can be, said, I will. And we did. Now, I called my district superintendent, who is next to the bishop, and asked him if he'd remarry us. See, I wanted the bishop to get the message. And my son was there. He's a grown boy. And my daughter and her husband, they stood up for us. Now, folks, I'm not as crazy as I look. I didn't buy a new ring. I used the old one. I kept it. And we were married. And then we moved to those three churches. They gave me three churches. God, they made a mistake. You don't give an alcoholic three of anything. The people over at one church would say, Reverend, we haven't seen you in about a week. And I'd say, well, brother, I've been over in this church working. And this church would say, Reverend, we haven't seen you in a while. And I said, well, I've been over here working. And I was laid up down to the lake drunk. I had a hard time telling people that. See, that's hard. One woman came up to me after I shared my story one day and said to me, Reverend, boy, I knew I was going to catch it then. She said, Reverend, how in the name of God could you drink like that? And I said, well, honey, I drank just like you did. I just turned it up and put it down. I carried a lot of guilt over that for a long time. I released myself from that. Betty and I moved to those three churches, and I carried with me willpower. Y'all know what that is. I swore to God that I'd never take another drink as long as I live. God had now given me a chance. I was remarried. My 16-year-old son was going to be living with us, and my daughter was happy that mom and dad were back together. And we went out there to that church, to that parsonage. Beautiful rural section in North Carolina. And I intended to do well. And I did well for a while. You know, you can white-knuckle anything for about 6-7 weeks. I never drank a drop with a Methodist. But I had a Presbyterian neighbor next door to me who said one Sunday afternoon, Sunday before Labor Day, Monday, he said, Reverend, we're having a party over at our house tomorrow, and do you drink? And I said, well, Richard, I do take a drink. And he said, come on over. And we did. And they carried me home. And Betty said to me, you know, there is that look, even in a non-Al-Anon's eyes. If you ever do it again, I'm gone. And I believed her. And I tried. God, I tried hard. I worked every angle I could not to drink. I couldn't do it. I had the best invitation not to drink that a man could ever want from a Catholic priest friend of mine, Father Frank. Father Frank was in the program. I didn't know he was. I just used to travel some with him, and I'd get drunk that night and be laid up and sick the next morning, and Frank would be feeling good, and I'd say, Frank, tell me how you quit drinking. And he'd tell me, but I didn't hear him. Frank came to see me in that 3-year period of time, and he said, he carried me, he's going to take me to, send me to treatment, he said, going to pay for it out of his pocket. And I turned him down. I said, Frank, I can do it myself. And Frank said to me, Catholic priest, respectable man. Quote, he said, I'll bear my ass in Belk's store over in the mall if you stay sober 90 days. My God. If you can't stay sober to see that happen, you can't stay sober. Well, I didn't, needless to say, I didn't stay sober. Frank's a good friend of mine now, and we're in the program together. And I oftentimes remind him of that, and he said I would have gladly done it. Bad 3 years. Let me tell you what I did in those three churches that I'm not ashamed of today because I've made amends for them. I preached funerals of people that I didn't even know died till after I got sober, which meant I did it in blackouts. I married young couples that if it hadn't been for my wife, I'd have gotten put in jail because I'd have lost the license. I visited the hospital of the sick, and I preached from the sacred pulpit, and probably worse than all, I administered the holy sacraments drunk. How did I do that? I did it because I could not do otherwise. You see, in order to work, I had to work in order to supply my needs. I had to work. And that was my work. No different from a school teacher who goes to school drunk in the mornings. God, I live with guilt. It's so tough getting up in the mornings and knowing that you're going to be preaching that day, and having to have something to stiffen you up and get you through until you can get home. I think I'd have had more guilt, but, you know, I can remember a lot of those church people come by the door on the way out and shook my hand saying, Reverend, has a good sermon today. And I'm drunk. I don't know who's the craziest, me or them. Well, it got worse. You know it did. It never got better. I'd never been to jail but one time in my life, and it was for getting drunk in my hometown jail, and I thought my grandfather would get me out, and he let me stay the night. But I've never been to jail anymore since then, but I've been to hospitals. God, I've been to a lot of hospitals. I was in emergency rooms. I've had surgery and broken legs. I've been in 3 psychiatric hospitals, long-term, one of them, Duke University Psychiatric Hospital in Durham, North Carolina. 30 days is long-term in a psych hospital. You know, I think it is. Well, one day I picked up the telephone and I called a psychiatrist I'd been seeing 10 years. See, I thought I was crazy. I'd been told that. I called him up and I said to him, Doctor, I need some help. You see, I'd never told him I had a drinking problem. I never told him I even drank. I need some help. And he said, come on over. Now, I'd been in that hospital before. If you've never been in a psychiatric hospital, you ought to go. You know, they lock the doors. You think they're going to throw the keys away. Alcoholics in a psychiatric hospital get well quick. We're afraid they're going to label us crazy. So we get well quick and we look good. And about 3 days, I got to be a member of the staff. You know how we work it. I was a trusted servant And the doctor said, Ray, you're doing so good, we're going to give you a pass. You know what happens to an alcoholic who gets a pass to go anywhere? It was in the cold winter time, and I put 2/5 behind my belt and the coat and came on back in. I drank more alcohol, and there was a lot of adolescents in that unit. And I don't ever want to forget this. They had about 25 or 30 little boys and girls, about 14, 17, 18, something like that. And they put me in charge of them. See, I was probably crazier than anybody else, but they put me in charge of them. And it snowed big that day and one day, and I said to the nurses, if y'all will get us a couple of buckets, we'll go outside and gather some snow, and we'll make snow cream. Now, you Floridians don't have any idea what snow cream is, but, you know, it's you just mix up some stuff. They'd never seen it, and the kids hadn't, so we went out to get some. Those kids got in a powwow circle out in there and got me in the middle of it, and they passed around some stuff that we were smoking. I'd never smoked anything like that in my life. I got so drunk that I couldn't find the hospital and finally got back in. Well, this is where my miracle started. I think it was that day that I began to realize that, man, I'm drinking more alcohol here than I was outside. And I'm using stuff that I've never seen before in my life, so I got to get out of here. So I called the psychiatrist and I said, Doctor, I'm drinking here and I'm using drugs here. And he said, no, Ray, I'm the chief of staff. Well, the next morning he came over and I'd had 2 or 3 big shooters and I blew my breath in his face and he wrote me a discharge. And then I went on back home to where home was supposed to be. Wasn't anybody there? My wife had left. And I swore to God that I'd never be sober again in my life. Pain was too bad. And the next day I went to get what I could and bought all I could of everything I needed. And I was going to hole up to die. It's when it gets dark enough, you can see the stars. And that's what happened. My wife and my best and only friend, now I mean that literally, my only friend, the Methodist minister, put their heads together. And God's grace worked in it. And they remembered an old boy who lived away from there. And Bob had quit drinking. Didn't use drugs anymore. They called him. And old Bob came and picked me up. I remember bits and pieces of it, but in the car, he didn't scold me. Now, my wife did. The last word she said before I left was, I hope I never see you again, you know, S.O.B. But Bob didn't scold me. Bob told me how he quit drinking. I didn't want to hear it, but he told me. And he took me to a detox. A.A. carried the message to me, dropped me off at a detox, and said, I'm going to be back to get you in a few days. And I went to bed and passed out, I suppose. And I woke up the next morning, and I knew it was a hospital. You know, you just can't forget hospitals. You've been there many times as I had. I knew it was a hospital. I just didn't know which one. But I knew if I could find out who my doctor was and where I was, I'd get out of that place. And so I was laid up in bed sick that morning, and I said, now, as soon as someone walks in here, first person comes in, I'm going to be just as cool as I can, and I'm going to find out where I am. Well, I said it as coolly as I could. The little pretty nurse walked in the door, and I said to her, honey, where am I? And she said these words, Reverend Moss, when you were my mom and daddy's minister, and it almost killed me. And I said, dear, just tell me where I am. And she said, you're in Asheboro, North Carolina. And I said, who's my doctor? And she said, Dr. Bob Williford. And I thought, it's all been a nightmare. It really, none of it happened, because it was 19 years prior to that date pretty close that young doctor, that same doctor, had given me that sleeping pill and started me. He didn't start me, but I started into an addiction that took me to hell. Well, it didn't take long when the shake started that I remembered that it wasn't a dream. It was real. On the way down there to that hospital, Bob, the AA man, said to me, "Ray, I'm an alcoholic. I know how you feel." Nobody had ever told me that before. The next morning, Dr. Bob sat on the side of my bed. Last time I saw him, he was a young man. He put his hand in mine and said to me, "Ray, my name's Bob, and I'm an alcoholic, and I know how you feel." Man, I've met two of these folks now in 2 days. I'd never met two alcoholics in my life, and here in 2 days I've run into two of them. Tell me it's not a miracle. A couple of days later, Bob, the original Bob, came, picked me up, and carried me to a treatment program, and I sat in that hallway waiting on them. You know, it takes forever. You know, everybody's looking at you and knowing you're alcoholic or something's wrong with you, and I'd vomit all over myself, and I was ashamed of how I looked. And I'm sitting there trying to hide this mess, and I stink. A fellow walks up the hall, clean, well-dressed, walks right straight toward me, stoops right down to my chair and leans over, not to embarrass me in front of anybody, and whispers these words right softly, "Ray, my name's Jamie, and I'm an alcoholic, and I know how you feel." And I've had three of these birds to tell me that in 3 days. Right then, what I call that magnificent hookup took place in my life. It's not a program of promotion. It's a program of attraction. And when Jamie stood up, I remembered those three good-looking, intelligent, smelling-good fellas who had told me, "I'm alcoholic and I know how you feel." And right then, I wanted what they had. And I set out to get it. That moment, I was attracted to those people. And I've got it. It's worked for me. I got well in 7 days. Get well fast in treatment. I cleaned up well, and the seventh day I walked up to my counselor's office and I said, "Dorothy, I'm going home, and thank you very much for what you've done for me. You've been great inspiration, and I've learned everything I need to know." And she said, "Ray, you're sicker than anybody I've ever seen in my life. I want you to go down to your room, and I want you to pray about this matter." Well, I was praying about knowledge of somebody that could come and get me and take me out of there, but I didn't have anybody to do it. I walked out her office, and she stuck her head out the door and said, "I mean, pray about it." And I said, "You know, you too, lady," and waved at her. Now, folks, since I walked in and met those AA people, God is working in my life, and I know that. It's a miracle. The spiritual life begins already, and I haven't made any kind of a surrender. But it's already working. God's moving. And I sat down on that bed trying to think of somebody that'd drive over to that place and pick me up and get me out of there. And two things came to my mind just back to back that I drank myself to sleep over many a time for years. On a Sunday morning, several years prior to that date, I got up, dressed, and was going to a Methodist men's group to speak. Oh, I'd been drunk the night before, but I'd been drunk, bad drunk, all night up into the morning. I was still drunk. I wasn't drinking, but I was still drunk. I pulled up to a stoplight. That light was red, and I stopped. It changed to green, and I can still see it. And I turned left, and I heard a bump, about like that. And I thought I'd run over a rock or something, and I stopped halfway in the turn and looked back. I saw a guy lying in the road. And I said, in that drunken stupor, somebody walked into my car. And I got out of that automobile, and there was a young man lying there, and I turned left in front of a big motorcycle, and he was dying. Every bone that I could see was broken. His face was mashed, and he was in convulsions, and I was using the comb to keep him from choking to death, and it seemed to me like it was an eternity before anyone came. And finally, someone came. I fed his family for 6 months. He stayed in the hospital that long. I didn't tell anybody I was drinking. They never gave me a ticket. See, I always stumbled up the steps. And then back to that thought, one morning my son woke me up. He was about 16 years old. He shook me awake from a drunken stupor and he said, "Dad, you know what you did last night?" And I said, "No, I don't, son." He said, "You slapped Mama and I loaded a gun and I was going to kill you, but Mama wouldn't let me." And I remembered that I just thought about and prayed that my daddy would die. What if that young man had killed me? It would have made no difference to that drunk. But for the rest of his life, he would have been marked. I got up and went down to Dorothy's office and said, "I'm going to stay. I need to." That was surrender. First time, surrender. I walked in my first AA meeting. Now, they carried me to AA, and there's a difference. There's a difference. You can take people somewhere, but on March the 24th, 1980, I walked into the first AA meeting on my own. I made the decision. And I went. Now, I'd been somewhere else that day. I'd been up to see my superintendent. See, I got cleaned up. I was going back to those churches, and I was going to preach the gospel and tell them about alcoholism and clean up the world. And the superintendent said, "Ray, the bishop and I have decided we don't need you anymore. You know, that put you on leave of absence." That's a kind way. Church got kind ways of saying things. And they said, that was just saying, "Ray, we fire you." And I got in my car and drove down toward my little old hometown where my mother lived. I had absolutely nothing. I came to AA with nothing. I had nothing that day, March 24th, 1980. I didn't have a wife. I didn't have a job. I didn't have any resources. I didn't have a place to stay. I went into my mama's house and I said, swallowed my pride and looked at that little gray-headed lady and said, "Mama, can I live with you?" And she said in the back room, "If you don't drink." She wasn't even Al-Anon. I walked into that AA meeting that night, and I always remember this because I look for the new man who comes to my home meetings. I look for him, the lady. I want to do for those people exactly what they did for me. You see, I walked in and they didn't say, "Where you work, boy?" If they'd asked me, I'd have died and I'd have not come back. They didn't say, "Where's your wife?" Because I didn't have one. And they didn't say, "Where you live?" Because if I'd have had to say, "I'm living with my mama and I'm 50 years old," I'd have died and I wouldn't have come back. But you see, what they did was say, "We're glad to have you." And when I left that meeting, they made me feel like I was the most important person in the world. I was. It was the first newcomer they'd had in years. Lord God, they're liking to kill me, you know. But when I left that meeting, I had 16 phone numbers and 16 names. And they said, "Come on back." Not only that, they called me. And they'd take me to meetings. And I selected me a sponsor. God, that's so important. If you're young and new in the program, get you a sponsor immediately. Hold on to him. You don't have to fire him. He'll work through those problems he's got if you'll stay with him long enough. Hold on to him. I found me one. I like this man because when they read How It Works, he looked at them and he listened. I thought, that's a newcomer, I believe. He had 20 years. But he was still listening to How It Works. And I asked George to be my sponsor, and he agreed. And he's been my North Carolina sponsor ever since, along with another fellow. And George wouldn't leave me alone. He never told me to do a thing. He just always showed me. He'd call me and say, "Get ready, we're going down to this town. It'd be about 30 miles away." Well, I had to go to work on third shift. And I didn't want to go to a meeting. Well, I'd have to go because he said we're going, and Sometimes he'd call and say, meet me in Kmart, and before I could say no, he'd hang up. I'd meet him at Kmart, and Sunday morning, when man ought to be able to sleep on Sunday morning, not run around to an AA meeting, you know. He'd show up. We're going down to the treatment program, to the detox. Well, I didn't want to go, but I said to my wife once, about 7-8 months of him dragging me all over the country, I said, you know, isn't it strange George needs to go to so many AA meetings? He showed me how to do it. Showed me how to do it. I was in a conversation with that fellow just not long ago. I get in conversations with him every week, but I was in a long conversation with him, and he doesn't ask me, Ray, you doing this, you doing that, or you ought to do it. He never says that. He just said to me, you know, they called me the other day from detox and wanted me to carry a couple of guys to treatment up 30 miles away. And I got a little irate at him for asking me with 30 years almost of sobriety, 25, 26 years. He said, I got on down there and picked those boys up, and I recognized one of them. We walked in the doors of AA together many years ago. God, how grateful I was that I'd gone to pick that boy up, he said. And I said, you know, he's telling me to start doing some more carrying people somewhere so that I might see myself in those people. I didn't have a job. Jobs are hard to find when you've been preaching for 25 years and people say to you, what you been doing for 25 years? You know, you've got that long blank spot in your resume. And I said, well, I've been preaching for 25 years. And they'd say, well, we're not hiring any preachers today. I went to work in the cotton mill. I said I never would work there. I went to work there at 16, and now I'm 50 years old, and I go to work back in the cotton mill. If I stay sober. Let me tell you about my first year birthday. If you can't remember your first birthday, you better start all over. My first year's birthday. 200 people there. I thought they all came to see me get a chip, but you know, they really came to an AA meeting. I had old Bob, who carried me to detox, had him to be my speaker. I'll tell you who was there. My mother was there. My wife was there. My two children were there. My mother-in-law, my father-in-law, my sister, those people that I'd hurt the most, and a host of friends. Old Bob made a great talk. I picked up my chip, and I looked for my son. You see, I had taught him just like my daddy taught me. I couldn't find him. He wasn't in that audience of people, and I remembered. He had been taught that men don't cry and men don't hug, because my daddy, being an alcoholic, had taught me that. And I'd taught my son that. And I walked outside in the parking lot, and I looked down across the way, and I saw him there, big old strapping submariner. I walked toward him, and he walked toward me. We got in a little trot, and we met in that parking lot, and I put my arms around him, and he put his arms around me, and the tears flowed, and he said to me, you're the best daddy in the whole world. You know what I had to do to get that? Don't drink, go to meetings, read the big book, and work with other alcoholics. My son embraced me for that. The best day I ever had in my life. Now, they've all been up from that. They've all been up from that one. I want to tell you right quickly about a couple of things that I think are so important. If you don't think it works, then you just got to try it. It won't work until you work it. Won't work till you work it. Man, I wanted to clean things up so bad in my life. I had done an inventory. I did a good inventory, and old Lee heard it. I was trying to make amends best I could. I had gotten along in my amends as far as me. I'd made amends to Ray, and that's about as far as I'd gotten, you know. I was procrastinating, you know, alcoholics sometimes do that. My sponsor said, Ray, you must get on with it. I think it's the only must he ever told me. And the next person on that amends list, after I'd done my inventory, that list contained Betty's name. God, I'd hurt that woman. My alcoholism had taken her from here to there and back into hell. And I didn't know how to make that amends. George said, do it. Well, I'm living with my mama, and you know you can't make amends in your mama's house. Just not when she's got two big old ears. And Betty's living with her mama, and we can't do it. So we met at Burger King. She's riding the meetings with me. You know, we've made that much progress. She is not sitting close. She remembered that night when the lights were lit, the candles were, you know. She was not going to be close. We met at Burger King, a little old table about like this one, and I pulled that amends list out and laid it down. And I told her what I wanted to do, and she, in Al-Anon, she knew what I was wanting to do. And I reached across the table, and I was going to tell her everything. Everything. She looked at me, and after I said to her, Betty, I've got to make my amends to you. And she looked at me right straight in the eyes. And she said, Ray, it's okay. And it's been okay. I tried to preach forgiveness for 25 years. Now I didn't do very good with it. And here was a woman in 6 months in Al-Anon knew exactly how to forgive. It's okay. By golly, it's been okay. Oh, we laugh about it now. We'll be riding down the road and I'll tell her something I ain't ever told her before. You know, I've just simply forgotten it. And we'll laugh and have fun with it. She'll do the same with me. My dad called me one day from North Carolina, and I'm living in South Carolina, and he said, son, I need to see you. I'm sick. Still active. I hadn't made my amends to him. He didn't understand what I wanted to say to him. I tried. I said, Dad, I'll come up tomorrow and see you. I drove that distance to North Carolina and walked into his house, and he lived alone, and he had been on a drunk for 3 months. He weighed about 110 pounds. He was dying. And he said, I'm so sick. I said, Dad, I'll go get the doctor. And he said, no, I've got a problem with alcohol. Well, he had never admitted that before. And, you know, I jerked his little butt up and put it in the back seat of my car, and I took him to a treatment center. He stayed 2 months. He was so sick. Well, I saw him between those times, but about 6-7 months later, I got a call from him one day. He said, son, I need to see you. See, I know this program well enough to know that he was about where he ought to be in his amends. And I said, I'll come up tomorrow. And I drove up North Carolina in my sister's house there in the little kitchen. Nobody home but he and I. Sat out at the table and he poured a cup of coffee. Little old arthritic cans. 74 years old. Reached across the table. I'd never held him before. I'd never cried in his presence before. And he took my hand and I took his and he looked me straight in the eye and he said, son, I got to make amends to you for all the hell I put you through. I looked him straight in the eye and I told him exactly what Al-Anon had told me. Ray, it's okay. I said to him, Dad, it's okay. We stood up, hugged, and cried. My dad died 2 years ago in August. He was sober 6 years, almost. I gave him every sobriety chip he had. Isn't that marvelous? You tell me this program doesn't work and bring you rewards. He was in the VA hospital in September, in August, 2 years ago. He was dying, and I went to see him, and I said, "Dad, I can't take you to a meeting. You're going to have a birthday on September 1, but you can't go to a meeting because you're too sick, but I'm going to bring some boys up here, and we're going to have a meeting, and I want to give you your chip. I've got it." And he said, "That's good." But he didn't make it. He died on August 29th of that year. Buried him on September 1st, his birthday in AA. While there wasn't a soul there in that funeral home, I walked over to his casket and I took out that 6-year chip. I stuck it in his pocket. I said to him, "Daddy, you're cold sober." God, what a fellowship. What a fellowship. I was up in North Carolina the other day. We bought a house there, Bob, to show you that, you know, you can go back home. We bought us a little house there. I bought me a little meal house, Betty and I have. We're fixing it up. We're going to go back there and retire in a few years. That's where I want to be. That's where I got sober, and that's where my life began. I want to end it there. I was up there, and I went to my dad's grave on his birthday. I hated that man, and I prayed that he had died, and I loved him when he died more than anything. And this is what the rewards, this is the reward of Alcoholics Anonymous. How can you make amends to 1,000 church people? How can you do it? I said to one of the preachers that followed me after I got sober, I tried to explain, you can't explain to people who don't know what we're talking about, what you can do. And I said to him, "I'd like to come back, stand up in the pulpit, make amends to all those people." He said, "Hell no. You've done all the damage in this church you're going to do. When you become willing, made a list of all persons we had harmed and came willing to make amends to them all." God, I wanted to. I didn't have any more amends I could think of except to those people. And I'd wake up at night thinking about them. And you know, if you wake up thinking about something, there's something wrong. Well, I'm living down here in Daytona Beach, and I pick up the paper one morning, and I see where the bishop who was in the Methodist Church in North Carolina, who's now resident bishop of Florida, was preaching over there in Daytona. And the thought came to me, you know, God put it there. The Methodist bishop is the head of the church. Methodist ministers answer to him. I can't make my amends to church people. They won't let me. But I can sure to God make them to the bishop. I wanted to tell him everything I'd done wrong in those churches. I wrote him a long letter, sent it over to Lakeland. He wrote me back. "They don't understand, you know." Well, he said, "Ray, you've never done anything wrong to me, but if you want to see me, I'll be glad to see you." And so I drove over to Lakeland. 5 hours I spent with that bishop. I did a fifth step with him. I told him everything I'd ever done wrong in those churches that I could remember, all my list of things. I told him about adultery, told him about cheating, lying, everything. God, we got through, and he said, "You know, I have never in my life heard that kind of honesty from anybody." And we had a prayer. I sang all the way back to Daytona. I sang and rejoiced over the fact that I'd made those amends. A few months ago, a year ago maybe now, well, it's been longer than that. The church invited me. About 8 years ago, the church invited me back. Put me in full status in the church. I didn't ask for it, and I didn't seek it. But they invited me to come back to be a part of the Methodist Conference in Western North Carolina. And I accepted it. About a year ago, they asked me if I'd come to that conference to do a seminar and a workshop on alcoholism, drug addiction. For those preachers. Lord, what an honor. What an honor. And I did it. And across some years now, I have been able to work with ministers' families, church people who have a problem with alcohol, and help them get the help they need. not easy. Frank said it last night, it's not easy to get here, and it's not easy to stay if you really want it. I want to share this and then close. A little boy went to school the first day. You ever put your kids on the bus, the first grade, watch them drive off with them? Well, this mother did. She dressed this little boy up. He had on a nice little coat, little tie, beautiful little pants, nice little pair of sandals. Hair was just right. And she walked him down to the bus that morning, put him on the bus, and she cried, and the bus took off, and she went back to the house. 2 o'clock that afternoon, she went down to pick him up, apprehensive about whether he'd not on the wrong bus or not, but sure enough, he got off, but he didn't look like he did when he got on. His hair was standing straight on his head. He had lost a shoe, his coat was torn, his bow tie was lost. Pants knee were torn, and most of all, the little boy had 2 black eyes. And his mama looked at him and said, "Son, who in the world gave you those black eyes?" And he squared his shoulders, stuck his chest out like a little Trojan, and looked her straight in the eye and said to her, "Mama, they don't give them away. You got to fight for them." You ask these folks who've been around here a long time if they've had to struggle for it. "God, I wanted to be sober 20 years the first month. Day at a time, hard work, work hard, go to meetings. I do the same thing today that I did when I first started." Turn of the year, somebody asked me, "Ray, are you going to do anything different to stay sober?" We had a meeting on that. "What you going to do different this year to stay sober?" Well, I went home troubled about that. I didn't know. Was I supposed to do something different? And I got all disturbed about it, and then I concluded that, no, I was only going to put a little more quality in those things that I'd been doing. You got to work for it. It's there if you want it. What a great conference it's been, and I want to thank you for allowing me to share with you. Betty and I are very appreciative of our recovery. It's people like you who brought us along the journey. Thank you so much.